From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. There's a new book out called Shocking Cases from Dr. Henry Lee's Forensic Files, authored by Dr. Henry C. Lee and Dr. Jerry Labriola. You'll all know Dr. Henry Lee as a chair and professor of the forensic science at the University of New Haven and chief emeritus of the Department of Public Safety in Meriden, Connecticut, lifetime distinguished member of the International Association of Identification and distinguished fellow of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Dr. Labriola is the co-author with Dr. Lee of three books and is the author of six mystery novels, including the recently released The Strange Death of Napoleon Bonaparte. You'll have to talk about that sometime. And the critically acclaimed Murders at Hollings General. And, you know, with the type of programming we do here on the on my show, and we talk about high-profile cases, I thought what better book to talk about than the book these gentlemen have. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Nice to have you, Dr. Lee, Dr. Labriola. My program deals with high-profile cases, and we've talked about, you name it, we've talked about it. And when we hear your names and we see the types of cases that you work on, the real-life cases, and I want to start with Henry Lee. What brought you to write this book? Because really, sir, you're a busy guy. How do you find time?
If you want to do it, always have time, especially if you have a partner writing together. You know, those cases we have to document because the whole justice system is pursued the justice, the fact. And, you know, those cases, and just recent years, so many people are interested that so we CSI, and of course, I also have a television show called Trace Evidence, and so many viewers, they want to read more. That's why we decide to write a book.
That's a very good point. And Dr. Labriola, when you see these types of programs on television, the advent of cable news, the internet, all that sort of stuff, it makes you, as a scientist, probably sit back and chuckle a little bit from what you see and maybe how the media covers things in, you know, 2-minute sound bites. And when you get to work with someone like Dr. Lee, it's nice to get out there, like Jack Webb used to say, just the facts.
Absolutely. you hit it right on the nose when you talk about you know, some of the television portrayals of this subject, highly dramatic. They do a pretty good job, but, you know, so many things can have to be done before the commercial arrives and so on and so forth. And working with Henry, with Dr. Lee, has been a pleasure. We've been known each other for maybe 20, 25 years, and a certain chemistry has developed, and we've arrived at a formula in writing our four books. I think you mentioned three. This is our fourth one. And it's a formula that has worked for us. And very simply put, I write and he edits, and then he writes and I edit, and we collate our material, and we arrive at a first draft, and usually a second or third draft before the final one is submitted to the editors and the publisher.
You know, Dr. Lee, with your program Trace Evidence on Court TV, seen in Canada where I am, and of course the United States, you try to bring to the forefront stories and what's behind these sorts of investigations and the cases that you cover. You've been criticized for being on the wrong side. You've been praised for being on the right side. How do you sit back and decide what cases you will take? Because, like I said at the start, you're a very busy guy.
Thank you very much, Dan. You know, it's an interesting question. Of course, before I was, the, you know, 50 years ago, I was a police detective. I started my career as a police officer, then become a captain in charge of a detective unit. That's almost, you know, 47 and 48 years ago in Taiwan.
Wow.
So that's why in 1964 I decided to come to United States to further my study, and subsequently I got my doctorate degree in molecular biology. I tried to solve the case with the actual physical evidence, science. Early days we solved the case basically based on confession. And if nobody confessed, we just run up the usual suspect, taking them to the back room, and with encouragement of water hose or blackjack, and get them more confession out. Of course, you know, we found out that's not only inhuman, but many times innocent people was forced into confession.
Right.
That's why physical evidence became important. After I come to the United States, finished my doctorate degree, I worked at NYU Medical Center, then I come to Connecticut in 1975, started for a forensic program at University New Haven, then joined the state police in 1977, became their laboratory director, subsequently became the commissioner for state police and public safety. So over the year, I see so many cases and so many things. When I work in the state police, of course, all those cases in Connecticut, that's my first priority. I have to do it. Then some other cases at the request of the prosecution. I do all the cases, and of course, once in a while, we do consultation. Those are requests by the defense attorney.
Right.
And that's why when you take a case, it's so difficult. Because one side going to like you, the other side definitely going to attack you. Never had a case that both sides, thank you very much, Dr. Lee. Just like a state police officer give a speeding ticket. Mark my word, not a single person gets stopped, say, thank you, officer, here's a fruit basket. Thank you for stopping me. It's a time, you know, it's the nature of the beast, that's our work. However, as a forensic scientist, we have to be totally objective and let the evidence speak for itself.
If you're just tuning in, Dr. Henry Lee is here and Dr. Jerry Labriola, and we're talking about their new book, Shocking Cases, from Dr. Henry Lee's Forensic Files. Dr. Labriola, I chuckled a little bit when Henry was talking about the old days, the blackjack and the water hose. And the reason being, and I'm not sure if you gentlemen know this or not, I'm also a police officer. I still work.
Oh, wonderful.
I have 27 years on the job, and I remember those days. But it's forensics that is so important. I can't think of a case that I've talked about here on my program, and I cover all the high-profile cases with all the cable news guests, that forensics hasn't been a huge part, Dr. Labriola. When you see, and I'm going to get away from the TV aspect here in a bit, and we'll get into specific cases, but when you see what you see on the CSI shows and the other shows and how it can be all solved in 25 minutes, and how people expect that sometimes, even me as a beat cop, say, well, they can check for fingerprints on CSI, why can't you guys? How does that affect your job and your perspective as an author?
Well, I think you've hit on an important point here, Dana, because shows like that and even DNA itself in many ways can be a double-edged sword.
Right.
In other words, people expect things to happen rapidly. DNA analysis, as good as it is, has become the gold standard within in the field, I think it's safe to say. And even before that, some of the developments, the new technologies, improvements in imprint analysis and so on and so forth, renders the situation in such a fashion that juries expect overnight you know, decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the defense, rather the prosecution, suffers here because the defense has more at its disposal to help its case. So while it's important that
Gary, I don't agree with this. You know, I think the CSI, basically the public, really interested in stuff, but unfortunately, in the real life, we don't have second commercial. And in real life,
right.
The physical evidence is not taking side or prosecution or defense. It should be equal. Both sides should have the access of the forensic evidence and should have the forensic expert. Should not just say, you know, physical evidence that's dictated by the prosecution.
Yeah.
With CSI, many defense cases also suffers a little bit, too.
That's not the point I was trying to make. I'm sorry if I said it wrong or, you know, gave the wrong impression. What I was saying is that the public at large and even juries expect too much because of some of the advances, particularly DNA. I think it's changed the way the expectations of juries.
And you know, and that was my next question, or along that lines, to Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee, obviously high-profile cases have been around for a long, long time, but before O.J. Simpson and all of the cable coverage and how the prosecution was put on trial themselves, and we can get into that later, but how the forensics were handled, whether it was a sloppy lab tech or the question about DNA and the public perception, I think that's a very good point, and I'd like to get your comments on that as to the public perception of, you know, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. that kind of nonsense that comes forward across in the public, and cases are decided by juries that don't have a lot of, and I'm not cutting down the jury system, believe me, but they don't have a lot of knowledge and a lot of understanding when it comes to how DNA really works.
Right. Not all the cases have DNA. DNA, of course, in sexual assault case, DNA become very important. If you find DNA in the vagina swab or victim's clothing and match the suspect's DNA, of course, that's irrefutable evidence. But on the other hand, many times you find the DNA, the victim and the suspect have a similar type of story, except the last moment, and the victim said, "Well, tell him to stop."
Yeah.
And suspect said, "No, she did not." So the question is: this is a consensual sex or a rape? DNA would not provide the answer.
Yep. No.
Cannot take the little sperm out and look at the sperm under the microscope and ask, how did you get out of there? It's almost impossible. So science have a limit.
Yeah.
And, of course, we as a scientist, the most importantly, we have to remain objective and relate the scientific fact to the core. Unfortunately, many times still have this, prosecution defense with each one taking side. The prosecution just won the small portion of our report to prove their case. Meanwhile, the defense used the other portion of the report to prove their case. Nobody interested the total fact. And as a scientist, we testify, many times we just, ask, just answer yes or no. As you know, then many times we cannot give an answer on yes or no. And we can't even have a chance to explain to the jury what the result means.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so true. The book is Shocking Cases from Dr. Lee's Forensic, Dr. Henry Lee's Forensic Files. Dr. Henry Lee is here, and Jerry Labriola. Some of the cases that you cover, one of the cases, Dr. Labriola, Kaylee Anthony, I know I've covered it extensively on my program here, a case that we haven't seen the end of yet. And it's hard, both as a someone who does broadcasting on the side, being a police officer, looking at the case, looking at how Florida releases information. I've interviewed Cindy Anthony and all the players involved here. That's a tough one, especially to write about, I'm sure, because all you have to do is look at that little girl's picture. And there's, objectivity is so important, Dr. Labriola, but will the people be objective when they come to this case?
Well, we didn't write about that case in this book. so I don't know whether I should be commenting.
Okay, no, fair enough, and I'm reading the notes wrong here, but
I'm on that case.
Yes, I know.
So that's why I can't comment on the case right now, because judge gave a gag order, except, you know, both sides, as you can see every day, stuff leaking out of the news. I don't know where they come from, but as an expert, we just follow the order. We don't talk about it.
I guess my question is not specifics about the case, seeing you never wrote about it in the book, even though you're working on it, Dr. Lee, but Dr. Labriola, when you have a case like this that has so much public attention, and let's get into the Spectre case, which you did write about, and is one that, again, I've covered on this program quite a bit, Phil Spector, Lana Clarkson, all of that sort of stuff, and again, objectivity. You want people to buy the book, to look at the facts, to look at what you have to say in there. How do you draw that fine line, Dr. Labriola, to keep everyone happy, I guess, is what I'm looking at.
Well, in that case, in all the cases that Henry and I have written about, I rely an awful lot on the material he gives me with respect to my role in the book, in doing, you know, a lot of the writing. He does as much writing as I do, but my primary role, even though I've had some training way back when I was in the Navy, I did some forensic pathology and then moved from that into medicine itself, but maintained an interest in forensic science through the years. And I've learned a lot from Henry during that time, but I rely a lot on what he gives me in order to, you know, put some of the thoughts down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
In the Phil Spector case, you say you've talked about it a lot, so I won't go into that. But then we have Murder in the Sacristy, which is that was a brutal murder of a nun in Toledo, which had rather bizarre ritualistic overtones, and it was 26 years or so between the commission of the crime and the adjudication of it later on, and there were allegations of a cover-up. But, you know, Dr. Lee testified at the trial of the priest, and he demonstrated how the perseverance of law enforcement officials and scientists, forensic scientists, eventually solved the crime.
Yeah, exactly, and a story, I've also covered that one, too, with a different author, and it was good old-fashioned police work, and you, like you say, dedication. And Dr. Lee, one of the things that impresses me, and I've just received your book, and I've gone through a good portion of it, is how you talk about the dual hazards of police work, being either killed or injured in the line of duty, and how a police officer, and this kind of hit close to home, because I know many, including myself, who... You know, you're not only judged by the court of public opinion, but you also have your own conscience. And all of a sudden, if you take someone's life in the you know, execution of your duty, there certainly are dual hazards. And you do talk about that in your book. Tell us about that.
Yes, one of the cases we cover involving Hartford police officer, a Midnight Patrol, respond to a call of a Tampa robbery. And he stopped the car, spotted the car and followed the vehicle. Then when the suspect saw a police officer follow them, they start bailing out, start running. Four of them run in different directions. The officer Allen tried to chase one, and meanwhile, he saw another person approach from the left and wave something in the hand. He tell him to stop, and somehow did not, and when he looked at this individual, turned around with a hand raised and the fire shot, turned out the decedent is a 14 years old kid, and the object is not a real gun, it's just a gun like a cigarette lighter.
Mm-hmm.
However, middle of the night, and the officer is alone, his life in danger too. So we, as a scientist, we only look at the scientific fact to reestablished the trajectory. We're not in the you know, sort of a position, judge somebody innocent or guilt. We have to sort of present the evidence to the grand jury and testify and let the chips fall. In my career, I investigate quite a few police shooting cases. There are many police officers died on the line of the duty. In the past 10 years in the United States, over 170 officers sacrificed their life. I was a police officer before. A couple of times, my life was put on the line. Mm-hmm. So I often say, you know, nobody can judge that officer, that moment, what's in their mind. We only can subsequently look at the physical evidence. For example, this case we cover, we look at the casing location, because from the casing ejection pattern, we know exactly where the officer located. And from the bullet direction, then we look at the trajectory. Then we look at, is this consistent with officer statement and or witness statement? Many times, because the officer is white, decedent is black, now you added another dimension because of the racial conflict. Anyway, those cases are the most difficult case. Mm-hmm. And right this moment, I'm still involved about seven of those investigations. We're in the process of writing a book with Dr. Wack and a couple other experts to address this death in police custody issue.
And it's an important issue, Dr. Labriola. I've had Cyril Wecht on this program also many times talking about high-profile cases. And when you look at, again, public perception, and this doesn't necessarily have to deal with the book that you've written right now, but even your thoughts about, you know, what we see in the media about police is the bad cops, the Drew Petersons or the alleged bad cops. And I've interviewed Drew Peterson, and I tell you, probably one of the most hated guests that I've ever had on this program, but yet one of the most listened to shows I've ever had on this program. And it seems like the image of the police, that they, whether it's a bad cop or if it's a bungled investigation, it seems that maybe those in charge, those in power, and as a mystery writer yourself, it's tough to put the cops on the good side, because it just seems like they've had a bad rap lately. Or is it just because I'm a little prejudiced here?
Well, no, you make a good point. I agree with most of it, but I want to deviate just a bit before we run out of time.
Sure.
Here, Dana. Because we have in this new book, we have four chapters dealing with four specific cases.
Yep.
And then in our last chapter, it's kind of a departure from the others. It's titled Genocide in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And what it does is highlight Dr. Lee's role in the excavation and in some of the cases, the identification of hundreds of bodies in the former Yugoslavia in 1995, I think it was, 95, anyway, mid-90s. And the evidence that he uncovered was later used to build a case against suspects indicted by the International War Crimes Tribunal, all of the Milosevic saga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were terrible. There was terrible brutality in that area back in the 1990s. Massive slaughters in the countries of all of Eastern Europe, and he pointed out that this was just senseless genocide. You know, and we both wonder. I think we put it in the epilogue of the book, even. We try to understand why people can't get along or couldn't get along, and in that case it was the Serbs and the Croatians and the Muslims who couldn't get along. It's still baffling, but his role, that is Dr. Lee's role, is outlined very, very well there, and I hope that people will you know, not read just the first four chapters and eliminate the last one, because that one is germane to what even still exists a little bit from what I understand in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't mean to take you away from that. That was my last question for Dr. Lee. And
I just want to add a little more. Mm-hmm. This book, you know, just like not just tell a story.
Right.
Each chapter we cover the scientific part. Each chapter mentions a new scientific technique in crunching or forensic laboratory. We share those scientific matter with the reader. Hopefully they can make their own judgment, look at a pure scientific way, forensic aspect of the case, instead of just like early days when you have a suspect, that suspect must be guilty. Then, of course, you want to build a case against the suspect, only look for witness or physical evidence linked to the suspect. Ignore those inculpatory evidence. What we try to introduce the concept is look at the evidence first, then develop the suspect. This is a much more objective way and more scientific way.
And it makes sense. That's how investigation should be done.
I think, I don't know if we still have a little more time.
Yeah, we got 2 minutes.
I want to just emphasize what Dr. Lee has said and underline it. The cases really highlight the value of both time-honored and new technologies in forensics, whether they involve examination of gunshot residue, and we talk about that to some extent, a bloodstain pattern analysis, bullet trajectories, which he's touched upon already in that Hartford case, DNA, which we've talked about. But it also illustrates the what I would call the tedious and steadfast work of police detectives. And you, as a law enforcement person, Dana, can understand what I'm talking about there.
Yep.
We try to emphasize all of these things in the book.
Excellent. And that's what we should do. And I hope everyone goes out and gets Shocking Cases from Dr. Henry Lee's Forensic Files, authored by Dr. Henry C. Lee and Dr. Jerry Labriola. In that book, you'll hear about the Phil Spector case, the Brown's Chicken Massacre in the Chicago area, murder in a sacristy, the shooting of a Connecticut state trooper, and the death of a 14-year-old young man, and, of course, the genocide in Bosnia-Herzegovina and the forensics involved with that. And it makes so much sense. Like my last two guests have said, look at the evidence before you get your suspect rather than the other way around. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you for having us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Dr. Henry Lee and Dr. Jerry Labriola, and it sounds like a good book. Make sure and go out and get it. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in just a minute with an update on the arrest of Dr. Conrad Murray in the death of Michael Jackson. What's happening to Sheen, Charlie Sheen, and everything else weird and wacky in Hollywood? This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You'll know my next guest, Robin Sachs, is a former ADA in Los Angeles County. She's a author. She has 15 years where she specialized in prosecuting sex crimes against children. Robin teaches parents how to recognize the systems of internet danger, identify cyber crimes and cyber bullying, and she's developed a personalized internet protocol for the family. She has written 6 books and is a guest analyst and commentator for high-profile news shows like this one. No, like Larry King Live, The Today Show, and Geraldo at Large. And on Wednesday, February 17th, 2010, she will be at the Children's Bureau Magnolia Place Family Center at 1910 Magnolia Avenue, Los Angeles, California, doing a seminar, and there's a reception and light dinner. I have to ask her again what that means, light dinner. And you'll find... You'll find more information out about that by going to her webpage at robinsachs.com. Good evening, ma'am.
Evening, how are you?
Good. We were supposed to have Entertainment Tonight correspondent Diane Diamond on with us, but she's stuck in a snowstorm in an airport or on an airplane in a snowstorm at an airport or something, and she sends her apologies, but that's okay. You and I can handle this.
Yeah, Oh, we can easily handle it. I'm kind of cracking up. All the people flying all over the place. It was a criminal law disaster yesterday. What should all the reporters do? Do they fly to Aspen? Do they fly to Los Angeles? Who did they deal with, Charlie Sheen or Conrad Murray? And the best part is I can tell you I've gotten 3 calls from producers from different networks, Good Morning America and the Today Show.
Uh-huh.
And they are all stuck at LAX, and Diane's stuck in Aspen. So there you go.
Let's start with Conrad Murray. Some are saying he's getting away very lightly. Some are saying this isn't enough. What are you saying?
What is Robin saying? I haven't even thought what I personally think necessarily of what charge I would file,
right,
except for the fact that I can tell you that the basis to file a second-degree murder ethically is and has been established. And it surprises me, knowing the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, that they took the kind of chicken maneuver and did the lesser crime of involuntary manslaughter. To me, it's just, you know, I don't like to think of politics playing a role. I don't like thinking of people being scared of juries. I don't like to be fearful of media type cases or anything else like that. But clearly all of those factors went into the prosecutor's minds because they did choose the involuntary manslaughter. And one thing that the other news reports haven't really talked about is we've all been talking about, you know, the choice of second degree versus involuntary manslaughter and was the basis there. The thing that was probably most surprising that wasn't there was that it was one count, period. I mean, that's what it was dealing with, the death.
Mm-hmm.
What about all of the drugs that were administered without a license and all of those types of charges that could have been filed? I was surprised that they didn't want to paint a picture of this guy, meaning Dr. Conrad Murray, you know, literally dispensing drugs into him like he was a candy machine and letting him suck up everything and pointing every drug at Dr. Murray. And that's where I wondered what happened.
Is this, and you and I have talked about this before, in fact, our last program, is this just the beginning of this case? Are we going to see more indictments brought against more doctors? I was actually surprised that this came down the way that it did, and I'm wondering again if there was some political pressure, some media pressure, and you know, hopefully that isn't what's going on here. But what's the rush? Why not do it right and bring the proper charges at the proper time and deal with everyone involved? Because Conrad Murray isn't the only alleged pill pusher here.
That's true. I mean, I think that there's a couple of factors. I don't know exactly what, you know, it's funny that you say what's the rush, and I've been saying what's the rush, yet every other news outlet out there is saying this has been 8 months, this is a long investigation, how much more time do they need? I mean, now you and I know that in 8 months on an involuntary manslaughter with drugs and many drugs and issues of causation potentially and sorting out all the potential co-defendants and so forth could take many, 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 many more years of time, frankly. So the fact that it came down so quickly, I'm with you. It didn't need to be necessarily this quickly, but it also may have been an alignment of perfect circumstances. First of all, you know, it seemed to me that there was definitely a push that was created by the defense saying, you know, we're here, we're ready, let's, you know, if you're going to do this, let's get this show going now. Also, the medical board who was present at the hearing yesterday, even all of the people realized that they were actually there. They may have been saying, listen, you know, let's get this, we're going to start working on these proceedings, and it would be a lot easier if there was a criminal case going on and that pressure. And then the other thing, which is kind of the underpinnings to the whole thing, is that 2010 is an election year for Attorney General, and Mr. Cooley is running for Attorney General, and it is going to be a big shakeup in criminal politics here in California. There's a whole bunch of new people coming in, and this would be a good opportunity to have, you know, another nice, firm media case behind your belt, which is why I think they did involuntary manslaughter.
Each week we do a segment called Nothing But the Sacks with former Los Angeles County ADA Robin Sacks, and that's what we're doing right now. Check out our webpage at robinsacks.com. Are we going to see this thing go to trial anytime soon, or are we going to be talking about this next year at this time?
You know what's interesting? I've had this whole case wrong, I guess. It's just, I'm here to say that I'm not right all the time. I mean, I thought that they would take more time. I thought that we could have seen the second-degree murder possibly, although I think that argument kind of went away. But I thought that this would be a case that could definitely plea, because I don't think that this is a case that the DA's office is looking necessarily at getting a big, fat prison sentence out of. I think mm-hmm. that's part of the reason why they started with the involuntary manslaughter, to give them the room to go down from there, even, in terms of time. But I have some pretty reliable sources here in L.A. who are defense attorneys, who are friendly with the defense team, who have talked to them and said, listen, you know, Dr. Murray's medical license means everything to him. His entire ego and identity is wrapped up in being Dr. Conrad Murray, and he is not going to go down he's going to go down fighting for that license. And if that's the case, then any conviction jeopardized the license, which means any conviction means, what do I have to lose? If he's going to get probation anyway from a court, then why not roll it to 12 jurors in a box? And, you know, for me and for you, and on a purely selfish level, I'd love to see this case go to trial, because I think it's fascinating. There's fascinating legal issues. Yeah. It's a celebrity case, but the celebrity is the victim, and the celebrity was a beloved victim, also a beloved tragedy in our history, also a beloved defendant in our history here in Los Angeles. So there's so many issues that I'd love to see them all get hashed out in the courtroom, and I think Dr. Murray just may have maybe fulfilling that wish of mine.
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, there's no reporter that has taken more flack about her reporting on the Michael Jackson situation than Diane Diamond, but we'll have to get her on again sometime, and the three of us can talk about it. Robin Sachs is here, and let's switch topics a little bit now to Charlie Sheen. My opinion, all you got to do is listen to the guy in the media. I like his TV work and some of his movie work, but he's a nut. And but again, when you look at the aspect of domestic violence, we've talked about it, you and I, on this program, and I have on this program for many, many years, and the epidemic of domestic violence. I think he has a felony and a couple of misdemeanors that he's facing. Who knows what's going to happen? They're looking for a deal. You hear one report, the next report is that they're not, and the protection order has been set aside, or has been lessened, I guess. What's your thoughts on the Sheen incident?
Well, you know, the Sheen incident, if you take the name Sheen out of it, it is purely a classic example of domestic violence. And in one way, I really am almost happy in terms of the things that have gone through the process. I'm because it just shows that, you know, stars are people too, batterers are batterers, and victims are victims, and they tend to act in the very predictable ways that both parties act, whether they're a star or they're not. The desire to get rid of a restraining order is domestic violence 101. We put a restraining order in place 1 week only to know that we're going to be fighting for it to remain in place some weeks later. And I think that it's incumbent, actually, on the judge and the prosecutors to be the bad people, the bad guys, in the eyes of the victim at least, and say, listen, we are going to protect you even if you are not willing to protect yourself. And I disagree with the modification of this protective order at this point without some sort of measurable progress in terms of counseling. If this was a completely isolated one-time incident where there wasn't a record of this stuff before, that would be one thing, but this judge is going to twist in the wind alone if something happens to Brooke or something happens to somebody else. So in that vein, the steps that are going on in the cycle of violence are too predictable for words, but also provide us and the public as a huge opportunity to recognize yet again that domestic violence exists. It exists in all walks of life and all people, all types of people. There are all kinds of conflicting reports, even though I loved Mickey Sherman's line on Joy Behar last night that everyone has a God-given right to have a dysfunctional marriage. I don't think there's any God-given right or constitutional right to beat your spouse.
Did he say that? Oh, no. Oh, Mickey. I think he said it probably because he was on Joy Behar's show, and there's a lot of... Well, anyway, I won't say it. Robin Sachs is...
Well, you know, we love Mickey, and he's funny.
Yeah.
He's funny, and you're right. You have a right to be in a dysfunctional marriage and
sure.
a dysfunctional... relationship, and you could be bizarre and rude and do whatever you want to do, but you can't hit and beat your spouse.
Yeah, And again, we can't make fun of domestic violence. It's a problem. And sitting back and trying to make light of it, and I know that's what defense attorneys do sometimes. It wasn't really that bad. Then there's a problem. And you brought up a good point. And if you're just tuning in, Robin Sachs is here. When you talked about the judge and relaxing the protection order and if something happens to her, you know, we see it somewhat with Bill O'Reilly when he'll go after, or his news team will go after a judge that makes a silly decision. But you have to wonder about judges. And, you know, they're doing their job, and sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't get it right. But ultimately, is it not the job of the court to protect the victim? I know the accused has rights. We get that. We understand that. But protecting the victim should be foremost, and I think we forget about that sometimes, or am I wrong?
Right. I mean, that's exactly, we do forget about the victim way too often, and way too often do you have these cases where a victim who is still very much within the control and power of the cycle of violence, they don't know how to protect themselves. And if anything we've learned in the court system is judges, as lawyers, and everyone else who's involved, is that it's our responsibility to step in when there's a violation of the law and to protect the victim. Because if something does happen, that it is going to rest on the shoulders of the system as a whole and the judge as a whole. And you don't want to be that judge who's named in the paper for, you know, letting that person out on bail or whatever, only to have a homicide suicide. I mean, look at that case that was on Facebook last week where the Facebook, the perpetrator, planned a murder-suicide. It was I don't remember how young the child was, maybe a 4-year-old son, something of that sort, and put, you know, updated his status every day on Facebook saying that he was going to basically kill himself and kill the kid. Yeah. And no one did a darn thing. I mean, it's all out there. So it's the same way, whether it's a Facebook status or online or in a courtroom. Once it becomes open for all of us to know, we all have a responsibility to do something.
Yeah, you're right. Robin Sachs is here, and we're talking about three of the biggest high-profile cases in the news and other things. And don't forget, Robin and Stacey Dietrich host the Justice Interrupted radio program Sunday nights on Blog Talk Radio, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Most politicians, when we sit back and we analyze them, we talk about them, we look at them, and we think, what a phony SOB that guy is. And there isn't any more phony SOB than John Edwards and the sex tape and all that sort of stuff that's getting as much play as some of these other high-profile cases. I personally think it's a waste of news time, but it's a presidential candidate, for heaven's sakes, and he's lied his way through it. Your thoughts on the Edwards coverage?
Well, you know, I think that actually, I'm going to have to defer with you on this one. I actually think it's really important to bring this up because, and even though it may seem like it's just salacious scandal and made more for a television movie or what have you, I do think it's a lot more deserving of attention than, say, our favorite subject, John and Kate plus 8. And really, I mean, this is someone who was, as you've mentioned, a presidential candidate. This isn't something that's just an interpersonal, you know, marital problem or infidelity within a relationship. This was an infidelity that runs rampant in our American culture. And, you know, John Edwards represents us as an American, and, you know, in some form or another, and he represents also the sadness that one must feel when there is some sort of cheating or infidelity that occurs, and a child is brought up, is the product of that relationship, and then that child gets to go out and hear their father, presidential candidate father, deny their existence. And then we wonder, you know, some 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, why this kid ended up the way they did or what have you. And so, I mean, how can you have someone sit here and make legislation on American values and make decisions on education and health care and finances when he can't even be honest to us, you know, when he didn't have to be? So I think it's important to kind of to bring out these weaknesses, not for political gain, but for also to show the breadth of a lie. It is really despicable, and it's really sad. But the thing that, just on a side note, since I'm blabbing so much today, that really surprises me, just as an kind of a spin-off topic, is so many people think that how many men are out there having affairs. I got to tell you, from this case, I can't tell you how many women have come up to me and have been pouring their guts to me about their affairs that they're having. So that probably needs a little more attention. I'd love to find out which women who are all political offices and which women out there are just as naughty as Tiger and John Edwards.
Yeah, exactly. And Tiger Woods, I was going to use as an example, when it comes to being in the public and that accountability as far as reporting their story. And, you know, I agree with you. And if we had more honest, and when I mean by honesty, these politicians, these high-profile folks that come forward and admit, yeah, I screwed up. Yeah, this is what I did. Yeah, I'll take responsibility for it. Don't lie about it. And it continues on. Well, my first segment tonight, I had Dr. Henry Lee on. You know Dr. Lee. And we were talking a little bit about the Spector case. And, of course, Dr. Lee came in and testified for the defense to try and make it look like Lana Clarkson's death was a suicide rather than a shooting. And my question to him was, he's done a lot of work on both sides, both for the prosecution, both as for the defense as a consultant. And when you look at cases like this now, Robin, whether it's any of the ones we've talked about tonight or on other nights, is it hard to put aside your prosecution hat and look at a case objectively? And I don't mean it negatively like that, because as prosecutors, as police officers, we look for evidence to convict. We don't always look at the big picture for evidence to acquit, or do we?
Well, actually, that's a fantastic question. And anyone who has seen a former prosecutor or a former defense attorney take the bench, you can see one of the very interesting things that happen. Everyone always gets nervous when the person who's the judge before you, and you know, you find out the history on them, and you find out, oh, they were a defense attorney, or they were a public defender for 20 years, or oh, they were a DA for 20 years. And one thing I have found to be true with those folks who do that, as well as with myself, is how critical we are of our own.
Mm-hmm.
So while we think we're very, you know, non-objective and very tough in terms of not being able to look at evidence about, you know, from a prosecuting point of view, you know, anything other than what would be convictable, good, you know, guilty type evidence, I sit here and look at some of these cases and find myself very able to see the defense arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And also feel this, you know, obligation to be able to look at a situation from both points of view. I mean, so that's why you hear me kind of waffle on this Michael Jackson thing, like, should he be, you know, charged with second degree murder, or should he be charged with involuntary manslaughter? I mean, I think that, you know, I'm beating up on the DAs, and frankly, I find myself beating up on the DAs a lot more than cops and judges want more than I used to, because I feel like, listen, when I was there, this is how I would do it, and I want to hold them to the highest standard possible, and I know that we can always do better. I never expected the defense to do, you know, to be the honorable, ethical, thorough people. That their job is to, you know, make the prosecutors do their job. And so when something fails, I unfortunately come after my own, which is not a real admirable quality at this point of my career, I got to tell you. But it's something that makes me, you know, kind of look at the situations and try to be as objective as I can.
I'm not sure if it's not an admirable quality. It's a quality that I look for in an analyst on television, because we've all seen the crime analysts, the news analysts, legal analysts, whatever they want to call themselves, come forward and be totally one-sided either way, and you have to look at the big picture. I think Robin Sachs will go after you if she thinks that there's evidence to go after you, and she'll also say, you know, this investigation should have been done this way or that way. If you want to check out Robin Sachs's webpage, make sure and go to robinsachs.com or the Blockbuster radio program on my favorite blog talk radio is justiceinterrupted.com. You were off Sunday.
Until we move in with you, until we move to Canada and live with you and your family,
oh,
that's what we're doing.
No, you don't want to do that, believe me. We don't have socialized health care up here. No, we don't want to get into that either. You took Sunday night off. You'll be back on on Sunday night. You stole my thunder. I was going to use a John Goslin joke that you and Stacey were adding John as a special correspondent to Justice Interrupted, because I'm seeing reports now on my favorite celebrity website, TMZ, with Harvey Levin, that John Goslin is looking to settle with TLC because he can't afford the lawsuit and will allow them to start filming his children again. We're going to hear a lot about this, Robin, and you've been called to talk about Goslin and all of this enabling, I guess, of his children. He wants to protect them, and then he doesn't want to. But really, when it comes to reality TV, it's all about following the money trail, is it not?
Well, it sounds like John Goslin, at least he's not lying about that he has to follow the money trail. At least he's being honest about it. I mean, I think that's the first bit of sincerity we've all felt, which is why it's on TMZ for a second, and no one's really talking about it all that much, because it makes sense for the first time. We're so busy right now with what Jersey Shores and all the other garbage out there that we're busy, darn it. This whole notion with reality TV, I mean, you and I fight about this all the time, but I got to tell you, I'm starting to think, you know, there is something to be said about the television that the masses can understand and relate to,
mm-hmm.
and the real masses of people. And, you know, the masses are saying John and Kate, you know, and all the fervor behind it is what they could relate to, or at least what they like to follow. So part of me that says, give them what, you know, if we need it, we'll breed it, right?
I suppose. I never thought of it that way. But, you know, you're right. There is an appetite, I guess, for that type of programming, whether it's some guy screaming about a cake that he just made, or someone how they dress, or someone. There's not a lot of good television on. And again, talking to Henry Lee about his television program on Court TV called Trace Evidence, where he actually gets down and talks about real life stories. You and Stacey do that on your Justice Interrupted show, again on the world famous Blog Talk Radio. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, Blog Talk Radio, we'll talk about Blog Talk Radio, because I've got my own issues with my crank callers on Blog Talk Radio. However, Justice Interrupted, it's evolving, actually. This has been a little bit of a work in progress with us, because what we are recognizing, which was our original goal, was to highlight the cases like you do here on Scared Monkeys, where we highlight the cases that don't get the traditional media attention, and perhaps weigh in with different ways to look at it, at least use our profiles, our platform, to generate some social action and real grassroots advocacy by getting people involved in telling us about their cases. That part of the show still is very much alive. We pick a case to talk about, and we hope to use our platforms and energy and really, frankly, piss people off enough so that they write articles, they blog, they write letters, they let people know and really make a difference that way. But we also then will contemplate some of the crimes that are going on today. And the part that makes it a difference than, you know, most shows is that, first of all, you've got two women, Stacey Dietrich and myself, representing both parts or two parts of the country, but, you know, way Midwest, you know, girl from the sticks and city girl here from Los Angeles, weighing in on crime. And really, we were two people who did not know each other but just shared a passion for justice and are totally different. I mean, she's, you know, the blonde tactical Barbie, you know, I'm the brown head cerebral type, she forgets her gun in the locker, I've got all my shit together. I'm just kidding. And I, you know, we rip on each other a bit and we poke fun because we do live in the dark world of crime. But really, it's fascinating how two people who you would think we would just absolutely agree all the time, and we probably disagree more often.
Yeah.
And I think that what we do together is we bring together the perspectives of people all over the country that someone somewhere will agree with either one of us. You'll definitely not agree with both of us. If you're doing that, then you're drinking too much. But one of us you'll agree with and hopefully be inspired to weigh in, listen, and make a difference.
Yeah, and it's kind of like what we do here. You bring a voice to those that haven't been able to be heard. And again, the show is Justice Interrupted. It's on Blog Talk Radio on Sunday nights. Go to justiceinterrupted.com or robinsax.com for more information. And, you know, the radio producers and the TV producers out there need to get off their fannies and pick up this format, because it's something that people want. People like to listen to, and certainly giving a voice to those that need to be heard. Robin, thank you, and we'll see you again next week.
Thank you so much. Have a good week, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
Right on. Okay, talk to you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Forgot about that. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. Remember, our webpage is at scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live, pick up podcasts of past shows, listen to the daily commentary, make comments, do whatever you like. Again, scaredmonkeysradio.com. And I always look forward to hearing from you. Send me an email, Dana, at scaredmonkeys.com. Always nice to get a note from a listener now and then. That's it. We'll see you again next week here on Dana Pritzer Show.
Listening to the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.